Hi, Sabrina George for New Comedy Radio, interviewing Simon Munnery for the second time as I completely bished up the first one, sitting outside in a park with his 1.5-year-old daughter Gracie, who might contribute at some level. We'll see what happens. Simon, when was the first action you took to get into stand-up?
First action? When I was at college, myself and my only friend went to audition for every play that was on in order to meet girls. We didn't get into any of them. The only thing we got into was an audition for a cabaret night. So that was my first gig, was I did a piece for which began, "Hello, my name's Matthew. No, it isn't. I was only pretending as a sort of joke." As that began, got deadpan, and it went very well. And I was stuck. Just carried on doing it.
So you gave up the acting. Why didn't you?
Never did.
Why did you think you got rejected for the acting?
Oh, I did get one role in this bloke was a computer scientist. He wanted to make an animation, but he thought he'd better make it turned into a play. It was a fairy story, and I was a prince. It was awful.
So you were actually in it?
I was in it,
But it was so dreadful you just erased it.
Blocked it out. Train. There's a train passing. Yeah. That's how it started.
And did you keep that up as a double act?
Well, we did it, God and Jesus, we were called. We did that for a few years.
Through university?
Through university and afterwards. Had one television appearance, one radio appearance.
And what did you read at university?
I did natural sciences, which means I did science. So in the end, the last year, I did a history and philosophy of science, but I didn't study very hard. I didn't go to any lectures or supervisions or anything until the last week before the exam. I went and met my supervisor for the first time. I was surprised to see him. I slipped through the net a bit because since I just never turned up, he never sent any reports, so the people who were in charge of my educational welfare never got any bad reports, so no one noticed. I just thought, they assumed I must have changed course, I think, but I hadn't. Anyway, so the last week I went to see him and I said, "Is the exam's coming up?" He said, "One book you could recommend I read before the exam." And he suggested Against Methods by Paul K. Fireart, which I remember to this day. It's a demolition of the philosophy of science. There isn't one. Disproving them all. Karl Popper's falsifications of the last attempt to make science. The philosophy of science is what makes science special. It's something other than other forms of knowledge, like horoscopes. Falsifications was the last great attempt to do that, but that's easily disprovable. Falsification is the scientific theories aren't true, but they can be falsified. But due to the theory ladenness of observation, any observation has theories attached to it. You can never actually falsify a theory because you just choose whether you want to falsify the theory or you can choose that one of the other theories attached is false. In the big world, it's not very important to say, you're looking down an electron microscope and you see something that doesn't fit in with your theory. You don't have to dismiss your theory. You can say there's something wrong with the electron microscope or one of the other many theories that are involved in the operation of that. But even at a big level with your eyes, you see wherever you see, there's a sort of, your mind puts a frame on it. So that was good.
And you got your exam?
I got a third, yes, I passed.
And what did you do with all the free time that you weren't studying technically at university then?
I was very depressed, sleeping and drinking, really. To get up about lunchtime.
Why were you depressed?
I don't know.
Because you weren't talking to anybody? You weren't doing anything? You don't think that was related?
I don't know, it's a strange anger at the world. I don't know what it was. Mad old time. Wasting my time, really, looking back.
At the time it felt...
Occasionally I'd write a joke.
Right.
I don't know, really justified.
And how are you putting your material together with your... what was your partner's name?
Steve. He was Jesus. I was God. how we put it together. Well, I write most of it, you come up with an occasional line, and then you perform it.
Right. How often? Like once a week, once a month? And was that up to you how many times you performed?
No, it's sort of whatever came in.
A demand.
We did a run a few times. We did a month in Edinburgh. Twice, for two runs.
That sounds quite motivated to organise that.
Well, it went well when we did this. Although it was a deadpan double act, so that was one of our big Edinburgh show, going the Pleasance. Never really warmed up the audience. Deadpan double act in a huge cavernous space. You need something to warm up first. You learnt later.
And were you well received by the critics?
Can't remember. We've got some good reviews, some bad ones. Our first ever performance, though, was at the Fringe Club. That's double act. I was in Edinburgh doing a review show, doing stand up. A character called the security guard, which is exactly the same as what I did in the double act. Sort of deadpan, slightly angry, strange man, sort of version of myself. And Steve was doing a play, and we tried to do a double act and tried out at the Fringe Club, which was a bear pit at the time. Lots of heckling. And we left the stage, we said, well, this bloke went back, come on, do a put down line, do a put down line. We said, Steve, come here and we'll kick your head in. And so he did, he started coming towards us. So we leapt, we couldn't see a thing without our glasses and the lights. Just leapt from the stage, crashed on these tables. Anyway, nothing happened. But then we got back on the stage and then more heckling was, we'll only go when you throw glass.
So they did?
So they pulled the plug and the security threw us out. It was very exciting.
Did you get an audience from that?
No idea. We had a sort of following in Edinburgh. College, you know, a few places. It was all right for a bit. Steve got fed up with it.
So what happened next?
He was lost. Lost.
But what happened to you in your
I lost him.
You lost him on the train somewhere.
I lost him. Lost him to the Academy. That's where he was gone.
And what happened to you next then? Did you set up yourself as a security guard, as a permanent fixture?
Yes, I was doing the security guard anyway, that's what I used to do, I was on my own. And I just carried on doing that. And I think at some point, Alan Parker, a Moria character, and Lee Gaines Seedon, we both, on some train journey, I wish I could remember where it was, some train journey, I remember both of us crying with laughter, thinking of different things to say in an Alan Parker type voice. The original gist of Alan Parker was between us, we came out. Just a bloke standing in front of rubble going, yeah. That was enough said. Just a sort of tone of voice, so then the jokes came later. And the League 8 Stadium, stick of different type, you know, attention scum. Seemed the funniest phrase we'd ever heard, to ways of addressing an audience.
So did you actually see a guy looking at the rubble, or did that
no,
just come to
I don't
mind?
Know where it came from. Sham 69, finding the first Sham 69 album. I mean, years after it was out, but I was just stumbling across it and finding it very funny. Tell us the truth. That was some remarkable thing. I think that was enough said. That was the origin. But both the League Games season with character went on to do and Alan Parker, both the germ of them was in the same mad drunken night.
With Steve?
Yeah. Alan Parker sort of got developed more quicker. But they both happened at the same one night. Next 20 years of my life. Looking back, of course, I regret it. What choice does one have?
What happened? What would you prefer to have done?
I don't know. Thinking about it now with our children and responsibility, it would be nice to have stable income and a house.
Been a real security guard.
That was an awful job. I was a security guard, so I got the idea for the act and the uniform. I got sacked.
Why?
Because I was on nights, and by the end of the night, I was a bit tie, a bit loose, a bit scruffy. And the boss came in, took me to one side in a special room, said, "Look, you're letting the company down with your dress. You dress properly. Only people who seem to be burglars, they won't mind, will they? But they still paid me for the training course that they never sent me on. I think it's just quite a legal requirement that they had to have paid you to be trained, even if you weren't actually going to be trained. So I kept the uniform and wrote some jokes with it.
So were you, like, from university going round the club scene then?
Well, at university I started to my first gigs.
Oh, we were?
My first paid gig was booked by Incognito. It was the Royal Oak. It no longer exists. It's a pub on Hemingford Road, Islington. And we didn't pay to get in, but the landlord was keen on comedy and he paid you 25 quid. I was overjoyed. 25 quid for doing something I enjoy. And it went all right, I think.
And then what, through him, you got into more and more clubs?
No, I was already swimming up to open spots. And I bought some, you know, I was doing a double act, doing shows when I was at college. And bought up different acts from London to appear at college with local support acts. I put on a couple of times, weeks of cabaret in a theatre. Put the posters up and did all the legwork.
Which college was this?
Cambridge, Trinity College, Cambridge. It was at the ADC Theatre. It's a big 200 seater. And filled it, and it was a good night. And we had Arnold Brown, Ian McPherson, Malcolm Hardy, Jeremy Hardy, John Hegley. That's the first time I met John Hegley. He remembers I bought him a pint as he came off. He thought, that's a good bloke. I've been buying him pints ever since. No. Podmorsky was his, or Andrew Benson was his, in fact, Andrew Bailey, who's still great. He wrecked. There was a big play on. It was the late night show after the play. I believe he wrecked the set. Just started swinging huge things around, as is his wont. Happy days.
And is that when you decided that was going to be what you did for the rest of your life? Or as long as they would have you?
No, I've never decided that. I just look back at it. The wind changed, I got stuck like it. So I never, because I enjoyed doing it, so I kept doing it. I didn't do much else. I didn't have a plan. Just one thing led to another.
And were you doing other odd jobs in order to keep yourself going?
Yes. I don't know where. I think while I was still at college, someone who was worked as a road sweeper and a dustman, a temporary replacement dustman, road sweeper. Like whenever they had a gap or something, they did dustman, they did a road sweeper. Coal shoveler. I did this. It was like a type as well. Some days I was a temp agency, sometimes I'd be typing for reasonable money. The next day I was in Rolls Royce at least. Shoveling coal was the most awful job. Middle of summer, two of us with white overalls on, masks. Whenever the screws that drive the coal into the turbines jammed, the blokes who actually worked there didn't want this job, so they get temps in on a tenth of the money. These blokes would be sitting there having fags, drinking cups of tea, watching us going into this coal bunker full of coal dust, shoveling out in immense heat. Filling up barrows and barrows of coal, taking it out while they watched.
To unjam it?
To unjam it.
Yeah. And then as soon as it unjammed, you were let go and they'd...
That's it, yeah. No. Once the hard work was done, they could go back. Yeah. One of those things. They get some students in to suffer. Well, I worked in a factory for a while as well. Actually, before I went to college, just sort of make money to live. And I was there, and I was a student. Put it written all over your forehead. Perhaps it was a mistake. There was no camaraderie among the. No one spoke real. And I was doing this utterly repetitive job of operating machines, making gas fittings. It was dangerous. If you made one mistake, you'd cut your fingers off. But simple and repetitive. It's just sort of making a good and stupid racket. At one point, I had a conversation with someone. I was so surprised. This old bloke came up to me and said, how are you finding the job? And I said, it's a bit boring. And he just said to me, some of us, it's our whole lives. Warped up. Yes, I'll never forget that. Thank you.
Yeah, that's the sort of thing that would motivate me into going into comedy, however horrendous it can be. When people talk about bad audiences, I think, that could be worse. It could be worse. Someone turning around to you and saying, this is my whole life.
Obviously, it's not his whole life. He doesn't sleep there. Probably goes down to the pub and plays pool after. There's joys as well. But yeah. Well, all right. But that's your life. You sort of, you can do something else. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. This is all I can do. I know something about comedy as well. You know, if I don't like it, I have to do something else. Not that I don't like it. Just wish I earned more.
Yeah.
I'd like to earn more. But wanting to earn more is a million miles away from earning more.
Yes, the two desires don't necessarily meet.
Well, there's one desire, the desire and the actuality. Simply wishing yourself richer is not a way to get richer. I just wish.
So you never had an alternative career that you could think of?
No, when I was 13 I was a computer programmer. I was, for that age, quite wealthy in my own right. I used to write computer games at the height of the computer game boom. Like personal computers, I used to write games for the Sinclair Spectrum, the ZX81, Sinclair Spectrum, the Commodore VIC-20. And I made quite a lot of money. So I always assumed I'd be a millionaire. Didn't think I had to worry about it. Somewhere along the line, I forgot to become a millionaire. Oh, well. Try not to worry about money.
Because it's one of the illusions I'm constantly confronted with. It's like, you know, are you professional? And it's like, well, what do you mean by that? Do you earn your living off comedy? And go, well, what do you mean by a living?
Yeah.
It's like £1 more than Social Security, but is that a living?
Yeah, it's what you do, isn't it? If you love what you do, that's enough, I think. And just be grateful for money. I'm always grateful for money. Yeah, you know. Just generally, the correct position is gratitude. It's just how you get there. That's the tricky bit. You know, when you feel grateful for something else, it's like, you might think your life's awful, but if someone was to try and take it away, suddenly, you know, like you're on a plane and you think it's going to crash and you come and go, oh, thank God. Or thank, you may not even put the word God in at the end, but that feeling of gratitude is the correct position, I think. But you don't always see it that way. It's obscured by clouds of worry.
Over the little things. What about, so what happened then? Did you get yourself an agent?
I went to Edinburgh with the Cambridge Footlights in the last year, and several agents offered to be my agent. One from Noel Gay, I remember when I had meetings with him. I went to the Noel Gay meeting and he said, I didn't really understand what he could do for me, and he explained he could get me writing work for Tracy Ullman. It just didn't appeal to me at all. Well, why would I want to do that? I'm a comedian. I like doing. I write things and then perform. And then John Coney from Avalon said, and it was just John Coney. He was Avalon, just him. He said, "I'll get you gigs. We charge slightly higher expenses than other agents, but that will go down in time. It was 15% to begin with. It'll go down to 10%." Once you're established. I'm still waiting to be established.
Did it ever go down to 10?
Yeah, but he did. You get your gigs. So that's where you do. That's what you work. You know, if you've rung up enough clubs to get open spots and gone through that, it was a pleasure to have that taken off. That short taken off. But in a way, maybe it would have been better just to keep, you know, cut out the agent. Kind of ordinary. You know, they make themselves seem essential, but probably they're not. If an agent wants you, you probably don't need them. when they don't want you, that's when you need them. It's one of those. They support you when you're up, kick you when you're down. That's a bit harsh.
So are you still with Avalon?
Yes, technically.
Does he know?
Does he know what?
That I'm sure you're still with him?
Yes, I think.
Is there are some comics that have agents and the agents sort of. Oh, I think yes. Hattie was saying. After something like a year, they sent her a Christmas card and just wise to me because it's a Christmas card and they said, oh, I don't know. She said, I don't think you're my agent anymore because I haven't heard from you for a year or something. And she's getting so much of her work in her own right. So I just, you know.
Yeah, most of my work. in my own right now. But occasionally I get a thing from them. I'm sure if something big cropped up, Hollywood started calling. Should stop changing my phone number. Maybe they're ringing the old one.
Yeah, suddenly your file will become live again instead of being in the redundant fund or whatever file or whatever it is. So you got yourself an agent and you're doing that, and then what happened? You just carried on. And how did things like Edinburgh work out then? Because that's considered very expensive to do.
First time I went with Avalon was doing God and Jesus, and we lost a little bit of money. But those days it was much lower cost. I mean, when I started, it was something like 50% break even. You needed to have it half full, which even in Edinburgh is a challenge anyway. Half full and you break even, and less than that you'd lose money, more than that you'd make money. But over the years it went up and up. The percentage needed, how full you needed it to be, that they took your expenses and all. Street team leaflets, bigger poster campaigns. I don't think it makes much difference. I've had massive poster campaigns and not gotten anyone in. I've had massive poster campaigns and got a lot of people in. I think in the end it's the show that matters really. But so then it went get going, and then you would end up that sort of debt scheme where you lose money, pay it off over the year, lose money again. It's kind of addictive. They always persuade you by saying you're investing in your future.
And our expenses are higher at 15%, and they will go down to 10%. Still waiting. Oh, exactly. So what happened then? You had these two characters, and you were touring around doing these two characters.
No, I was doing security guard for several years. I don't know how many. And then started doing Alan Parker, and that would die 2 out of 3 times. When it went well, it was hilarious. Other times, it was just people thought it was a serious. Well, who is this bloke? Is it being serious?
How did he evolve then?
Evolve?
Yeah.
I don't know about that. School of Hard Knocks. Is it things that worked. It was quite fragile. Sometimes I'd do it in a way that was funny. Other times, it would just seem like it was exactly the same words, but it was serious. Would laugh.
They take it as hardcore philosophy.
As for real. I see the joke in it. And sometimes, you know, half the audience would find it funny, and the other half don't think. But gradually it got to the stage where it just worked it almost every time, got better and better, and then it peaked, I suppose, sometime in the mid to late 90s. But then I kept doing it until I was sick of it and wasn't doing it as well as I could. And now it's been fallow for a while, but I've always done it at benefits or. Never really stopped doing Alan Parker, and then the last couple of years I've written a new 10 minutes. So he's got a new breath of life
for Alan Parker.
That gig, so doing a long gig of sort of 10-15 minutes of that, just sort of in between chatting, put a bit of energy in the room.
And do you prefer doing it as doing comedy as a character rather than as yourself?
Variety. I like going on a bit of a chat as myself, and then I can do a character, and I'll do my character. I'll do a poem, a song, read out some jokes from a book, take the money, go home. I've got a new character, which I've never yet performed, except to my wife, who finds it hilarious.
That's why she's your wife.
Yes.
What's your new character?
It's an Australian poet. Australian love poet. Quite bawdy, quite earthy. But yeah, another person's laughed at it as well. Where are we going?
We're going. Grace is taking us to the swings. The slide.
I think it's the seesaw.
Let's cut that off for a break in a minute.